We start with the summary of the week's top medical news from Physicians First Watch, read by editor Amy Herman. And then Dr. Ali Raja, the editor-in-chief of NEJM Journal Watch Emergency Medicine, and myself discuss a new government white paper with Dr. Paul Bittinger. The subject of the paper is preparing for mass casualty events. Here's the news.
Hi, everyone. Our first story. An analysis of patients in Ireland calls into question the widespread use of statins for primary prevention in low-risk adults. Researchers found that over the last three decades, the proportion of adults eligible for statins rose from 8% to 61%, and at the same time, the number needed to treat with statins to prevent one major cardiovascular event rose from 40 to 400. Next, some sobering news from the CDC. A new report finds that the suicide rate among people aged 10 to 24 increased by 56% from 2007 to 2017. And among children aged 10 to 14, the rate nearly tripled over the same period. Elsewhere, a meta-analysis finds that three non-pharmacologic interventions benefit patients who have dementia and agitation or aggression. In particular, multidisciplinary care, massage and touch therapy, and music with massage or touch therapy were all found to be clinically more efficacious than usual care. Next up, for the small subset of patients who have reflux-related heartburn that's truly refractory to proton pump inhibitors, surgery might work better than medications. A randomized trial finds that nearly 70% of patients who had surgery had treatment success, while just 30% of those on medical therapy did. And finally, those of you with questions about Shingrix, that is the newer shingles vaccine, will want to check out Dr. Paul Sachs's latest post for NEJM Journal Watch. He answers some of the most common questions about the vaccine there, and readers are finding it really helpful. You can find it at blogs.jwatch.org. And that's it for this week. Stick around for Joe Elia's latest clinical conversation.
This week, Ali Raja, the editor of NEJM Journal Watch Emergency Medicine and executive vice chair of the Emergency Medicine Department at Massachusetts General Hospital, joins me as co-host. Dr. Raja and I will speak with Dr. Paul Bittinger, one of the participants in a roundtable discussion held earlier this year by the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response in the Department of Health and Human Services. That discussion sought to alert emergency planners that, sadly, traditional triage approaches may fail in the face of mass casualty events that are dynamic and ongoing, like mass shootings. That discussion led to the publication of a white paper in July called Mass Casualty Trauma Triage: Paradigms and Pitfalls. Dr. Bittinger directs the Center for Disaster Medicine in the Emergency Medicine Department at Mass General.
Welcome, Dr. Bittinger, to Clinical Conversations. It's a pleasure to have you here. For the listeners, we actually work together. Dr. Bittinger and I both work in the Department of Emergency Medicine here at Mass General. And in addition to running the Center for Disaster Medicine, he actually runs Disaster Management for Partners Healthcare. Dr. Bittinger, many of the listeners to this podcast are not going to be experts in disaster management or even emergency medicine. So I wanted to ask you first, what are the big lessons that they should take from this ASPR white paper?
I think one of the most important services that this white paper provides is to dispel myths that a lot of people think they know about mass casualties. At some point in everyone's training, they've learned that you should sort patients in a mass casualty and identify those with life-threatening injuries, red patients with the most critical injuries, obviously. And everyone thinks they know maybe how to do that. But what this paper really highlights, and it's built on discussions with responders to events like the Orlando and Las Vegas shootings, the Boston Marathon bombings, many other mass casualty incidents, is that how these events look in the real world isn't how they are taught in medical school or what people think they know. And what's relevant, I think, to your listeners is a lot of responders aren't necessarily emergency physicians. Bystanders play a huge role, and unfortunately, any one of us could be on the scene of an event like this. So it's important to know how to react and how to respond. In terms of specific lessons, I want to highlight a couple. One is that any hospital could be the main receiving hospital for a mass casualty incident. And what I hear a lot when I talk to physicians around the country is many of them say, well, I don't work at a trauma center. We're really not going to play a role. And it turns out that that's not true. In a mass casualty incident, as many as 80% of people will go to the closest hospital, and they don't care whether it's a trauma center or not. Interestingly, in the Las Vegas experience, and it's highlighted here in the white paper, many people took an Uber or a Lyft or plugged in on their smartphone, go to the hospital. And none of those identifies a trauma center, an appropriate hospital. It just gives you the shortest distance to the hospital. And therefore, the closest hospital ends up overwhelmed. And even if you're not a trauma center, you're going to be faced with bleeding patients. So that's one really important lesson is no matter where you work, understand that your hospital and you personally have to be ready for mass casualty events because unfortunately they do occur anywhere, and how patients get distributed can be very variable. Secondly, there's an important lesson about how to distribute ambulances and how the medical system needs to respond. Mm-hmm. What that means is of course we're focused on getting patients away from the scene to hospitals with ambulances. But again, especially if that closest hospital is not a trauma center, part of the EMS response actually has to take patients away from that closest hospital that needs trauma support and transfer the patients to a trauma center, just like that closest hospital was a trauma scene.
Right.
So patient distribution is essential. And if any physician, any one of your listeners finds themselves at the scene of an event like this, understanding how to work with EMS, how to help direct patients to the right destination is an essential part of it. The last big takeaway that I would say any reader, even one who's not involved in emergency medicine or disaster response, should understand is that patient transport is one of the most important priorities above almost everything. So arterial hemorrhage that's uncontrolled clearly needs to be controlled. And I hope everyone understands the importance of tourniquet training. The National Stop the Bleed campaign says that every physician and frankly, every layperson,
right,
as much as possible should be trained in tourniquet use. But the point is that 90% of preventable death happens due to bleeding. And even with a physician's skills, outside of tourniquets, there's very little we can do to prevent death with hemorrhage. And so the patient does not belong on a big red tarp with all the other red patients. Patient doesn't need to be weighted and sorted until we know exactly how many patients there are before they're transported. Critical patients need to be in the back of an ambulance and get to a destination as quickly as possible so they can get transfused and they can get definitive hemorrhage control. So these three lessons of every hospital has to be prepared. Patients need to be distributed as thoughtfully and carefully as possible, not just from the scene actually, but from other hospitals. And that really the most important part of triage is much more transporting as soon as you suspect a life-threatening injury, as opposed to waiting and confirming and getting full scene information. Those, I think, are the most important lessons learned from a whole bunch of tragic events.
Dr. Bininger, I did a series of interviews on Clinical Conversations with the emergency department heads after the Boston Marathon bombings. And they all emphasized how lucky Boston was because the attack happened right at shift change. But the thing that impressed me was the fact that the Boston hospitals had practiced regularly for just such an event. How hard is it to arrange that kind of crosstown collaboration in your experience?
I think, unfortunately, it's pretty variable. I think there are multiple communities. I'm really proud of what Boston's been able to do, but there are others that have a culture of preparedness, that take it seriously and have communities where the hospitals come together. The work across the country in the last several years to develop healthcare coalitions supported by ASPR, I think, has also been helpful. But there's still communities that really rely only on their trauma center or on their large hospital to shoulder the burden of emergency planning. And as history keeps showing, that's probably not enough. So I think the most important thing is to help everyone realize the reality of the threat. There's just a good amount of data out there that talks about how these events can overwhelm certainly any one hospital, but even well-prepared communities, and really the importance of fast action. One thing that I think the Boston hospitals can credit part of their response to is recognizing that emergency departments are almost always full, because that's the nature of emergency medicine across the country. And if you don't have clearly practiced and well-defined procedures to open up capability within your emergency departments within minutes, you're not going to have the resuscitation spaces that you need to receive the incoming victims. So your nurses, your physicians, but actually, frankly, your transporters, your janitorial staff, others all need to be involved in a moment's notice mobilization of emergency department capability. And you know, one thing that I would highlight, it's really not so much in this white paper, but I would suggest, is the whole of hospital approach is catching on, where even internal medicine specialists play a role in mass casualty response, and that's to make room in the emergency department. So if you take a full emergency department, you have lots of patients, many of whom are likely to be admitted to an internal medicine service. Having internists respond just like the trauma surgeons will to the emergency department, but instead of beginning trauma resuscitations, they instead take over the care of those existing ED patients to free up the emergency physicians, and often, at least in my own hospital's protocol, push the stretchers out of the emergency department to other destinations so that you have the space to take care of patients. That's part of a whole hospital response that, at least in recent experience, has been proved to be potentially life-saving.
The recent incident in Texas, where somebody with a semi-automatic weapon was riding around in a truck and killed eight people, is very different in its character, because that you would call a dynamic situation. There weren't as many casualties as there were, say, in Las Vegas, but it was something that would tend to sow panic in an entire community. Las Vegas was different in that there was a single event space, but there were thousands of people actually in that space. And as the first responders were showing up, they were being fired upon as well. And there were more, I think there were sometimes something like as 10 times as many casualties from non-firearm causes than from firearm causes, because people were running and tripping over each other.
What's common, whether it's an event like Las Vegas or the one you describe in Texas, or even more complex coordinated attacks, which unfortunately is the evolving face of terrorism globally, is they all have a common denominator of fear and panic. Right. The public now knows enough about these events that loud noises, we've seen this before, can spark an entire crowd to move and run away, even just with a noise, let alone with a real threat like gunshots or explosions. And so absolutely, you're right that trampling injuries, others are very common, in addition to the penetrating trauma, say, that we see with a bomb or a gunshot. I think, you know, responders are human too, and that sense of fear, that concern for personal safety, is very real. And frankly, you know, if you haven't been in the middle of a situation like this, the fog of war, the difficulty in really appreciating what's going on, isn't understood enough, I think, by most people. So, you know, you can take lots and lots of events, including, say, the London subway attacks, now more than 10 years ago, where there was an explosion in a subway line and patients streamed out of two different subway entrances because patients left in the center of the tunnel. And for a while, London thought they had two bombings as opposed to one in a single subway tunnel. Paris took a very long time to figure out exactly how many attacks were going on and what part of the city, what was vulnerable. And even in both Orlando and Las Vegas, both of the hospitals were locked down for a period of time and staff forced to hide because they thought there were gunshots going on inside the hospitals themselves.
Right.
So that difficulty of not knowing what's safe, what's not safe, how do I protect my facility, my person, my patients, is real. And, you know, we all fall back to the level of our training. We fall back to what we've practiced before. And so practicing in as realistic environment as possible, so that you understand you're going to be afraid, you understand things are going to be chaotic, you understand you're going to have poor information. Ironically, or maybe not so, helps people understand that fear is normal, uncertainty is normal, and I'm going to fall back on my medical training, and I'm going to keep my basics about me. Treat patients with the ABCs, the basic hemorrhage control principles that hopefully we all know. And I will keep an eye out for my own personal safety and others.
Dr. Bettinger, given the potential variability in the kinds of incidents, as Joe just mentioned, everything from active shooters driving around in a truck to explosions to anything else, a lot of our physicians are wondering how to best counsel and discuss this with their patients and what they can do to help their patients better be prepared for the possibility of something like this. Now, in previous years, we talked to our patients about the need to learn CPR. Are you now seeing a shift where we're seeing physicians actually talk to their patients about the need to learn, for example, about hemorrhage control?
I think so. I think there are a couple of things physicians can do no matter what kind of practice they have. I think the Stop the Bleed campaign, which was led by the American College of Surgeons, but supported by so many other physician groups, including the emergency physician groups, is really important. And it is much more likely that any one of us will be around a car accident or an industrial accident, something else that causes arterial hemorrhage,
right,
than a trauma or terror event, excuse me. But almost no physician was taught how to properly use a tourniquet in medical school. And I think it's okay to admit that. But a $20 tourniquet on the internet can be life-saving. And keep it in your glove box, keep it in your backpack. It is not possible for almost anyone to improvise a tourniquet. Without undermining the heroics of those who responded to the Boston Marathon bombing, the improvised tourniquets with ties and belts did not control hemorrhage. And you need a purpose-built proper tourniquet in order to control arterial hemorrhage. So I would strongly encourage people, look on the web, look with your local American Red Cross, other chapter. The Stop the Bleed trainings are easy to find. And I think, as you said, years ago we taught people to do CPR. A few years after that, we said automatic external defibrillators are important, and now they're in shopping malls, and they're pretty much ubiquitous. The last, I think, leg in, or the last part of that chain is hemorrhage control.
Right.
The other thing I would say, without trying to be too controversial, is I think, the vast majority of these events are firearms injuries. And I think there's been a great move, actually supported by the American College of Surgeons, as well as emergency physicians and others, to treat firearms like a public health issue. Just like treating automobiles as a public health issue, saying we're not trying to ban cars, but we're making them safer, we're trying to make their use safer, I think has been relatively well supported. And in fact, as I understand, has been somewhat supported by the NRA.
Yes.
So no matter where you are on firearms issues, treating it as a public health issue, treating it as a safety issue, there are some very common sense strategies that are well endorsed by folks on all sides of the debate. And physicians can have responsible discussions with their patients to increase firearm safety and decrease the frequency of firearms-related injury.
I'm going to put a link to the white paper on our website, which is podcasts.jwatch.org, and it will be available free there. What would you recommend to other systems? Maybe, I don't know, let's say Manchester, New Hampshire, a place that's probably, and I don't want to pick on Manchester, a place that may not have practiced for mass casualty events.
I think, honestly, the most important use of this white paper is to get it in front of the right community responders. So the city and county emergency managers, the EMS service leaders, and the emergency physician leaders in a community. Because again, what I think is most important in this white paper is to dispel the myths that a lot of people still think they know about mass casualty events. And the mistakes that are made in planning to assume patients will only end up at trauma centers, or that it's really important to keep people on scene to provide care as long as possible to stabilize them before transport, or that hospitals themselves won't receive a large number of victims. Very few hospitals are prepared for 20, 40, 100 victims to arrive by Uber or Lyft and have to triage those patients and bring them in and begin resuscitation. The paper is really groundbreaking in the way that it dispels myths in an evidence-based way by those who've been through these experiences. Bring together the EMS emergency management, emergency medicine leaders from communities and have them reassess what their community mass casualty plans are. That I think is the most important thing. And if somebody reads this and says, boy, yep, I already knew this, that's fantastic. But I think there still are a lot of communities across this country that unfortunately plan on somewhat outdated notions. And I would love for them to get a chance to revise what they do before, unfortunately, some event happens elsewhere in the country, which just will happen.
Well, maybe our listeners can seed their communities with copies of this PDF.
That's right.
Dr. Bittinger, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about the white paper today.
It was my pleasure to join you both. Thank you so much.
That was our 239th episode. The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Ilya.
And I'm Ali Raja. Thanks for listening.